hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first matter on the agenda this morning would be the rules hearing. Proper notice was published in the State Bar Newsletter, and we will proceed in the order in which they were published in that notice. There have been various writings submitted by people who chose to do so. The court has had an opportunity to read all those responses, and so we would request that any oral responses this morning be directed to any other matters not contained in the written ones, because we've already had a chance to review those. Yes, and I should announce that I was contacted by Mr. Janko this morning, and that number two on the list, the proposed amendment to 15628C, has been withdrawn because Mr. Janko believes that his proposed amendment is already contained in another rule, so we will not be dealing with proposed rule number two this morning. The first proposal then will be the proposed amendment to 15-6-4D related to service of process as submitted by the Office of the Attorney General. Are there any oral comments on this proposed rule? Mr. Mallon?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to state that the...
You want to come up here because we do record these.
Never had the privilege of being in the rules here before. I'm not sure what the procedure was. I just briefly like to comment what was the rationale behind the offices of Attorney General's proposal. Our office has been involved in some litigation involving international defendants through various countries, Indonesia, India, and Canada, and Greece. And during the process, we found that the South Dakota rules currently do not provide for any service of process in foreign countries. There's some unique provisions when you deal with foreign countries, such that, like for the Hague Convention countries, anybody that's entered into those treaties, the federal law would preempt. Our rules do not recognize that. Also, there's some countries that have service of process provisions that are unique to that country, even though they haven't joined the Hague, and that they are not currently covered in our rules. So what our office did is we looked at rules, in particular, Rule 4D under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in other states, and based upon that, we developed what we proposed in the petition. It's substantially similar to Rule 4D dealing with service in foreign countries, but because of the difference between how service actually takes place under the federal system versus the state, we adopted some of the provisions of other states about the actual service procedure similar to South Dakota.
I have a question for you. In view of the national and multinational basis of this, do you think that this might not be really an internal rule, but a rule that that you should submit to the legislature for change? Do you think South Dakota legislature ought to have their shot at this rather than the South Dakota Supreme Court in an internal rules hearing?
We contemplated that, Your Honor, but we determined that the appropriate place for this would be through this court, because it's dealing with service process, which is uniquely the jurisdiction of this court. And so if the legislature always has the ability to decide that it wants to review if they have that opportunity. But we decided this was the appropriate avenue for it. And part also is just to limit the focus to the international service auditors. As Your Honor is aware, once you submit a bill, that entire provision is open for scrutiny.
So what you're saying is the long-arm statutes actually create the jurisdiction, and this just implements how you get service?
Exactly.
All right. Any further questions for Mr. Hallett? Thank you, counsel. Any further comments on the proposed amendments to 15-6-4D? All right. Two, as I've noted, has now been withdrawn. The third proposal would be the proposed amendment 15-6-34C, submitted by Attorney Stephen Sanford. Mr. Sanford has sent the court a letter saying he could not be here today. Are there any further comments? comments on proposal number three? There being none, we'll proceed to four, which is also submitted by Mr. Sanford. This would be proposed rule amendments to 15645A. Are there any additional comments on this? Mr. Barnett?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thankfully, the state bar rests on the, written comments that we've submitted. We think that the bar commission has directly informed the court that they would like the opportunity to have the entire membership review that and debate it at the annual meeting on whether or not it's appropriate to adopt this modified federal rule.
So you're basically asking us for a year then?
That's correct.
All right.
That's as to both three and four, not just four.
That's correct.
Okay.
All right. Now, thank you, Mr. Barnett. Any further comments on three or four? If not, proposed rule change number five, but amend 15146.1 relating to challenges for cause. This was submitted by the Judicial Conference. Any comments in addition to the, I guess we can see Dave writing on this one. Any comments? There being none, proposed rule change number six would amend 15266, submitted by Attorney Mark Meyer-Henry. Any comments on six? Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Your Honor. Proposal number six actually generated considerable opposition from the bar commissioners. Nevertheless, the official position is let's take a look at it and have a debate on it, but it is a substantial change. And without prejudging what the membership may actually determine on the merits of it, we can ask the court to defer on frankly, on all these that we've commented on. I will tell the court that if you determine to defer action, I'm going to bring all these to the membership at the June meeting. In addition to that, if given the opportunity, I'll be referring these matters to the appropriate standing committees for their review and recommendations. Ultimately, it would be a membership vote, and the court can determine. I will advise the court of the action, whether the court wants to defer based upon the results of the membership. Whether you want to take it up again next February, of course, it's in your discretion.
I don't remember Mark Meyer-Henry recommending, stating what the reason for this was or the necessity for it. Am I right on that, or did he advance a reason for changing it from 60 to 30?
I can tell you, Your Honor, that in a telephone conversation with Mr. Meyer-Henry, he told me that he thought that the federal rule was a 30-day, and he thought that was an adequate period of time, and he thought that the additional 30 days is unnecessary, and he was arguing to me that this would expedite the process. The bar commissioners, and I advise the bar commissioners.
Well, it is expedite the request for extension of time to get things done.
I'm not here to argue the merits. I suspect that the membership will oppose this, but my team leaves aren't involved in it.
There is a first swelling within the bar for this, is there?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Well, you'd be aware of it, wouldn't you?
I'm not presumptuous enough to suggest that I know what all 2400 or something are thinking.
Well, we don't have it here today, anyway.
No.
All right. Any further comments on 15626, the amendment? If not, we'll go to proposal number seven. We'll amend SDCL 2127 18.1 relating to certificates of probable cause and their issuance by the South Dakota Supreme Court. This was proposed by the Supreme Court. Any comments on this? Okay. Number eight, the proposed amendment to SDCL 23A 2013.1 relating to challenges for cause in criminal cases, again submitted by the Judicial Conference. Any comments? There being none, number nine, adoption of a new rule relating to the appointment of counsel in death penalty cases. This is submitted by the Office of the Attorney General.
Thank you, Craig Hicks, the Deputy Attorney General, and worked on drafting this rule and just wanted to discuss briefly the rationale for it. As the court is probably aware, 28 U.S.C. Chapter 154, which includes sections 2261 to 2266, provides for an expedited federal habeas proceeding in those instances in death penalty cases where the state has adopted a mechanism for appointment of counsel for state post-conviction proceedings. In the case of this state, it's done through habeas corpus. There are benefits to this with the federal law courts to both sides. To the criminal defendant or habeas petitioner, he's given a right to counsel who meets certain standards, which are set forth in the state rule and set forth in our proposal. The habeas petitioner also gets a state, or rather a federal court, stay of execution, essentially the minute that the state court counsel is appointed. So in addition to any state court might give, there'd be the protection for the criminal defendant. He'd have a federal stay immediately. Also,
when does this trigger at? After the, well, the direct appeal's on, or when?
No, it doesn't trigger until the conviction is final, which is after the state direct appeal. And so this would not affect appointment of counsel for trial or for direct appeal. And anyway, the standards for that are already governed by state and federal constitutional cases, so it really doesn't add anything. But what it does is it gives the defendant an absolute right to counsel based on the standards that are set forth, and the federal government would require that before they'd give these other benefits. The other thing that it does, it gives the criminal defendant counsel immediately, since the rule requires appointment within 30 days after, basically after the case is remitted, when the direct appeal is finished. The benefits that would accrue to the state really are more in what happens in federal habeas after the state courts are done. This really doesn't speed up anything for the state or for the defendant while it's in state habeas, but once it gets over to federal habeas, there's a shorter statute of limitations. There's also specific times within which the federal courts must decide these cases, which would speed the matters up in federal court itself. And those are some of the benefits, obviously, that the Attorney General's office is looking at. There would be a limit in the federal court of 180 days after the filing of the federal habeas petition within which the court must decide it, which may be extended for only 30 days. If that isn't observed, then you get mandamus from the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals is also required to decide the matter then in federal habeas within 120 days.
But this is after the state?
This is after
the state habeas.
After the state habeas.
So when you say when the final decision has been made, are you saying it's the final decision on the direct appeal? For the final decision that triggers this in after the habeas? Would we have two attorneys going at the same time on two different things?
No, you don't. Okay. You don't have an attorney for post-conviction habeas corpus until after the direct appeal is finished. And really, this rule has no effect until after the direct appeal is finished. Now, it doesn't. It does go into effect immediately upon this court's remitting the matter.
But I thought that then, you know, when you go through the state habeas, I thought there was some federal case I looked at that says, boy, you didn't bring that up in the state habeas, so you're kind of precluded from doing it here.
Right.
But so, when this, after the final decision's made, then would a court have to appoint someone to handle in the state habeas? And then after that's done, they aren't successful. The federal, is that what you're saying?
The federal is, at that point, the federal kicks in. And those are really...
So you avoid state habeas or what?
No. You go ahead and you have the state habeas in the normal course. This does not affect the course of the state habeas other than the appointment of counsel itself right at the beginning. So the matter would be... In ordinary cases, if you had the death penalty affirmed by this court on direct appeal, the matter would then be remitted to the trial court. The trial court, under this rule proposal, would have 30 30 days within which to appoint counsel, and then that counsel would have the responsibility to pursue the state habeas. That would go forward, and the state habeas would not be affected or speeded up by this rule at all. It would continue to be undertaken in the usual way that it's undertaken under the rules that are in the statute. But once that's finished, then
the same attorney would have to go to federal court.
No, you'd have. Well, it's possible, but I think what would be done is that there'd be a federal habeas petition filed. The federal court would appoint presumably a different attorney, because I've never seen one. There may have been one or two of them that use the same attorney, but ordinarily you get a different attorney in the federal habeas. And what this affects is...
But you still got the same one paying the county.
No. When you get the federal habeas, the federal government pays for the lawyer. So that's one advantage.
I have a question as to are these absolute minimum standards of competency? There can be no bending at all in these?
That's the intent, and the reason for that, Your Honor, is that that's the federal court's requirement, that you have binding mandatory standards. And
I'm, for South Dakota, it seems to me that subsection C of section 3 is a requirement that's way too strict.
Okay.
It says the attorney or attorneys appointed shall have attended and successfully completed within 2 years immediately preceding appointment at least 6 hours of training or educational programs on the subjects of the post-conviction phase of criminal investigation and federal and state aspects of death penalty cases. So as I read that, that looks to me like they're really talking about not 6 hours, but 6 hours for both subjects, or 12 hours on those two, because then it says and, not or. And another question, you know, in South Dakota, our CLEs and this type of thing, you really don't get a certificate of successful completion. You just participate in them, and hopefully your attendance and your attention span is good. You know?
Frankly, Your Honor, I don't have any problem, and I don't think the office has any problem with removing the successful completion requirement. Probably not with changing to some degree the language of Section C if the subjects remain the same. And the whole problem with adopting a rule like this in a state like South Dakota is that we have fewer practitioners, and we probably also have fewer people who have done all these things.
May I suggest, if your rule gets adopted, you won't have any practitioners in this state willing to take this. We don't offer CLEs that you say are now mandatory in the state. I've never seen these types of CLEs offered. You're making mandatory minimum requirements for previous experience, which will preclude a lot of people. Come to example of Joe Butler that represented Mr. Ryan so capably. He couldn't take a habeas under this.
He couldn't be lead counsel, Your Honor. There needs to be one lead counsel, and others. Other co-counsel can also be appointed who don't meet the standards.
Well, and maybe we should also then, if we're going to have these requirements for defense counsel, require the same for prosecutors. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I've personally done the things that are in there, at least at the post-conviction and habeas stage. I haven't tried the case, but you know, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. And the reason for these requirements is not that we want to preclude people, but it really is the nature of the case law that's come out of the federal courts, because they've been relatively strict in some of these requirements, and I know these are ratcheted back from the ones that have been approved, say in Arizona, for example. Of course, there are going to be a lot more attorneys who qualify in Arizona, I'm assuming, but we wouldn't have a problem with taking it back somewhat, but the only thing I would point out to the court is that, and I agree with the letter that was filed by Professor Chris Hutton from the University of South Dakota School of Law, and that is that if you get requirements that are much less than this, the probably won't be approved by the federal court anyway. So in that respect, we may be losing out there. I think that perhaps the CLE requirements could be decreased a little bit. I've seen CLEs that have, for example, dealt with post-conviction habeas or state habeas corpus, those kinds of things.
Do you have any idea how difficult it is for a circuit judge to find an attorney that's willing to take habeas to begin with without stacking this on top of it for this kind of undertaking?
I understand that probably is difficult. I know it's difficult to find someone to represent Mr. Brent.
One other question. Does this rule reverse Jackson versus Weber?
It may, and that's a point that's been brought up by the other people who objected to it.
Now that's a suggestion of the South Dakota State Attorney General's office. That didn't come from the feds, did it?
It's in the, well, there are several provisions of the federal law, but it isn't required by the federal law. The one thing I did want to make sure that I raised on that
was Weber wasn't a capital case.
No, but it's a habeas case.
Yeah, so I don't talk about what the federal is requiring on the capital type cases.
That's true.
Then why would we melt that one in there under our state procedure? Is that mandatory or is it the same consideration?
I wouldn't say that it's mandatory, Your Honor. The reason we put it in there is because we see the defendant
I didn't like the Jackson decision. But
well, that's... If you read my briefs in that case, you know I felt about that, John. No more needs to be said. But the rationale is that there are other benefits given to the defendant but we also wanted to assure that even if what we have here isn't that broad, we wanted to assure that the provisions of this rule would not in themselves be grounds for further habeas relief. For example, if someone were appointed who doesn't meet these standards, we know that the federal courts are not going to give us the benefits of the shortened statute of limitations and so on.
Why wouldn't the standard be applicable also to the individual that defends the case at the actual trial?
Not required by the federal government in the statute.
It seems to me like, having read some cases in, I don't think it's in our state, but in some states, it's unbelievable what courts have appointed in a serious case like this, you know, just the nature of the case. And it seems like that would be one place where you'd really want to maybe have some standards. And it's like the chief says, it's difficult to find, but it still seems to cause less problems when you get to habeas, doesn't it? If you've got competent counsel.
If you've got competent counsel, and I think that as one aspect of Jackson versus Weber that I certainly agree with is that the circuit judges in this state have a tradition of appointing competent counsel, and in the death penalty trials that we've had the most eminent criminal lawyers in the state defending them, so it's really not a problem that way. And as far as this rule is concerned, it's also not a problem that we've had, I don't think anyway, had people who are even arguably incompetent in the state habeas or in the federal habeas aspects of this. It's just that these are the requirements that the federal government has set down, and that's what we're trying to follow. And these requirements that they've set down go only to state post-conviction matters. They don't require that any particular standards be adopted for trial and direct appeal, so those would be governed by state law and by the constitutional standards under Strickland and so on.
Alright, so I'm not quite clear on your answer as to subsection C of section 3. Can we change successfully completed to participated in?
Yes.
And change it down to, a total of 6 hours rather than 12 hours,
yes,
on two different subjects?
Right, yes. I know that the Bar Criminal Law Committee also suggested taking it down from death penalty to either criminal law or habeas corpus. I think that if you do that, I guess I'd like to see the subjects in 6 hours. I think that should be 6 total rather than 12 total. Um, but we'd really like to see the subjects in there, because I think anything less than that is going to give us great difficulty telling the federal court that these standards are enough. That's...
How do, you know, we don't have where you get a certificate doing from CLE.
No, I don't believe so. Just attendance would be sufficient.
To show that you attended at that time when there was a subject, or you went out of state or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because if you go out of state, you're very likely to get a certificate, because most states have mandatory CLE. But those are some of the basic requirements. I did want to, I think most of the introductory remarks have gotten to my questions. I did want to look at a couple of the objections that have been filed or comments that have been filed on the rule. And the first one was that I'm sure Mr. Barnett is applying the wanting another year to this rule as well as to the previous ones that he's commented on. And the reason that we would like to see this rule adopted now is that there is a sort of case law to the effect that if these standards are not in effect at initial appointment on post-conviction, then they won't be applied by the federal court. Now, that would mean that as to two of our death penalty cases, one of which is now in state habeas and the other which is in federal habeas, this isn't going to apply anyway, but it's possible that it might be applied to the others if it's adopted at this time, rather than a year down the road or something. I'm not so foolishly optimistic to think that this court's necessarily going to affirm everything that we've got and up before it right now. That just doesn't happen. However, assuming that there would be one or two of the cases that are presently before this court affirmed within this year, before this court has another rule hearing a year from now, then these will not be applied to them. So that's why we wish to have the court act on it now. I think we've already looked at the requirements, the CLE, and I noticed that the bar committee did, criminal committee did comment on experience requirements. We would, you know, we, as I said, I think we have some difficulty in getting experience requirements and other requirements to pass muster in the federal courts anyway. We would not want them weakened a great deal. I think that especially as these standards relate to post-conviction habeas, we would want to have some experience requirement remain in direct appeals and habeas at least. We just indicated no mind for removing the successfully completed clause. Sort of summing it up, I just asked the court to again take a look at Professor Chris Hutton's letter. She is basically, I think, favorable toward adoption of this sort of a rule. I think she also looks realistically at the fact that the experience requirements are somewhat difficult to fulfill. As far as what other federal courts have approved, she also cites about three cases in there that we were aware of, most of them from the Ninth Circuit, that have approved. There's one for sure that's approved some requirements. Those requirements are stricter than the ones that we're proposing, but of course it's out of the state of Arizona, which is a much larger pool to look at. And other than what's been approved here, there, to my knowledge, there has been no Eighth Circuit case law, and I just did another Westlaw search last night. I don't believe there's been any Eighth Circuit case law specifically approving this type of a rule. Missouri has one. It's been up in front of the Eighth Circuit a couple of times, and they've avoided ruling on it by saying that the district court has to rule first or something else, but that they have not specifically approved it. They've not specifically disapproved it. So that, I think, is the status of the law as to approving these rules in the Eighth Circuit. Any additional questions?
Thank you. Any further comments from any be present, sir.
Chief Justice, I'm Brian Schreiber. I'm with Law Firm of Dave Morrison Schreiber. I filed the objections on behalf of the Criminal Law Committee of the South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association. I really don't have any more comments to make other than what are in my objections have been submitted. I think essentially the Criminal Law Committee agrees with the spirit of the new rule, the spirit. But I think the one point that's been made is it's going to eliminate some excellent attorneys in our state. In one of the conference calls that we had for our committee, one of the attorneys, this rule in its present state would eliminate is Jeff Larson. Jeff Larson took a look at, I believe it's section 3B, where the requirements for at least one evidentiary hearing in the Higgins Corporate's actions and a couple other requirements, and he said, this eliminates me. Personally, I've known Jeff for a long time. If it eliminates Jeff Larson, it's eliminating the wrong people.
We are talking about the Jeff Larson with the Public Defender's Office in Sioux Falls.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. And I know this court is very familiar with Jeff and his abilities, and I don't think these rules are intended to eliminate people like that at all, but intended to make the standards higher for these types of people and the experience also. Other than that, I don't have any more comments other than what's been my objections unless the court has some questions.
When you say fear of the spirit, you mean you think there should be standards?
I think there should be some educational standards. I think I'm not qualified to do what's in here. I've never even done a habeas action. My only experience in habeas has been when I was a law clerk for the First Circuit and I assisted in writing the opinions, and that's been my only experience with habeas actions. I should never be appointed at this point in time to represent somebody on a habeas action, so there should be some standards. These are just too high for South Dakota at this point in time, is what we believe.
But how the court has to, like, I heard Bill Foley. Someone has to do habeas. Do you have someone out there that all of a sudden advertises in the Belfast PD or something that he's a habeas expert or what?
I don't know if anybody would advertise that they're a habeas expert if Judge Bashir or somebody called
Jeff. You'd have to take it, wouldn't you?
You'd have to take it. But I think as an attorney, I would probably point out to Judge Bashir is, I've never done this before, but if you're telling me you think I'm the guy to do it, I'm going to do it. And then I'll call Jeff Larson and say, can you help me out?
That's always a learning experience. I like to go up to the clerk's office and say, tell me whether there's a habeas file. I'd like to look at it. Sure, I'll tell
you. Is that what I'd do?
But I mean, that's what we have in this state, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't know of anyone in this state that I can think of, very few, that specialize, like in some areas, in criminal law.
And I agree with you. And in smaller communities, it's tough to do that. I know firms are trying to do more of that because that seems to be the trend, but in smaller towns, sometimes you have people that comes in the door, fortunately or unfortunately, because the bills still have to be paid.
And usually, the ones that are willing to do that are the ones that are just the newest in town, too.
That's very true. That's very true.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Schreiber?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further comments? Mr. Barnett.
I've already filed my written comments, but I think some of the judges have raised some questions about the COE. The policy that the state bar operates by under a COE program is we don't offer topics that won't reasonably anticipate 100 lawyers or more. When we have very esoteric areas of the law, we can't meet all those individual requirements. There are some general bankruptcy would work, but there's some very sophisticated bankruptcy work, COE stuff, and we let them go out of state and pay their own costs to do that. We can't justify COEs that don't attract that kind of number. The only exception we make to that is the income tax COE. We have 92 people come. I can tell you in advance 90 names, and they come every single year, and so we kind of link at that. With regard to the certification, we do certify attendance for those members of our bar who are licensed in other jurisdictions with mandatory COE requirements, so we do certify. So the state bar, if the court decides to adopt something like this, we can meet those requirements. It would be expensive to offer what would have to be every 2 years a cycle through repeating this kind of educational topic. My biggest concern is that there's been some considerable discussion about how many people are out there willing to do it. When the judge calls you, you do it. If the judge calls me and I said, well, I'd love to do it, Your Honor, but I haven't met these requirements, I'm off the hook. And I don't know of anybody that's chomping at the bit that wants to do habeas corpus work or, for that matter, take criminal court appointments. And I kind of view it in the
now, I know in some of your CLEs that I've attended, you've been able to tap on in-state expertise. I assume in this area that would be fairly difficult. Are you looking at then bringing out-of-state lecturers in?
Well, frankly, as I read the rule, I'm not sure that I can't take people who aren't qualified to take the appointment to teach the course and then have the students teach the teachers and get around that. And I think under this proposal, we could probably do that.
The state bars had some, you know, like criminal things, and they had some habeas.
Sure.
You're just talking if we could just specialize on that.
Our general cycle, Your Honor, is we'll take topics that, let's take evidence. About every 3 or 4 years, we're going to run an evidence update. Every 3 or 4 years, we're going to run a UCC or business law update. And we cycle those through, and then obviously we watch what's happening with court decisions and what the legislature is doing to see if we have hot topics where we need to address them much more quickly. One of the concerns that I have on this particular proposal is because it isn't a black letter replication of the federal statute, is that we could adopt this rule and yet not have the 8th Circuit approve it. In the meantime, we've undertaken a substantial burden upon our membership, upon the court, and upon the state bar's educational arm without any guarantee that we're going to get the carrot, you know, the promise of the shortened statute of limitations. At a minimum, if the court is inclined to go ahead, it ought to be conditional upon, but only if the federal court system approves the final draft of this, because it would be a real shame if this court and the state bar undertake all this additional work and the expense attendant to that, and then not get the benefit that they're promised.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett.
Thank you.
Any further comments on this proposed rule? There being none, then those are the 9 proposals before the court. We will take the matter under advisement, and we'll be in recess for approximately 10 minutes if all parties are ready to proceed in 10 minutes, because we did get done about